cable that has no insertion loss. You set it for 1 microvolt. The signal generator is producing 1 microvolt, assuming the load is 50 ohms. And by definition, because you've got a lot of attenuation set on that attenuator, that signal generator is very close to a 50 ohm source impedance. Now, what happens if I don't put the receiver there? I put some kind of a very sensitive voltmeter right on the front panel of the signal generator. I set it for 1 microvolt, and I'm not creating a 50 ohm load. What will I measure? I won't measure 1 microvolt. I'll measure 2 microvolts. Believe it or not, the signal generator is doing exactly what it's supposed to do in that circumstance. Let me drop it for a minute. If I was drawing the equivalent circuit of an ideal signal generator, inside the box that is the signal generator would be an ideal voltage generator. An ideal voltage generator is something that generates volts, but it has an internal impedance of 0 ohms. Whether you short it out or open circuit it, whatever, you set it for 1 volt, it produces 1 volt. That's an ideal voltage generator. And in series with it is a 50 ohm resistor. So now, the far end of the 50 ohm resistor is one of the terminals coming out of the front panel, in my example, and ground is the other terminal. So that now I set up that signal generator so that, in my example, I want 1 volt to be delivered across a 50 ohm load. The internal ideal signal generator is really generating 2 volts. And now the internal 50 ohm series resistor and your external 50 ohm load constitutes a 2-to-1 voltage divider. The signal generator, the real ideal signal generator inside the box, is generating 2 volts. 1 volt is dropped across the 50 ohm resistor that's inside. 1 volt gets dropped across the 50 ohm resistor that's outside. That's your load. And so when you ask it to generate 1 volt, it really generates 2 on the inside. You remove that external 50 ohm resistor and replace it with a 10 megohm digital voltmeter. Now there is no current flowing through the internal 50 ohm resistor. There's no voltage drop. You will measure 2 volts. So a general rule of thumb, you take any impedance matched radio frequency signal generator, and maybe it's also true of audio, and you don't give it the right amount of load resistance that it was calibrated for, and you can present an open circuit instead.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
You present an open circuit instead, you will get twice the voltage that you think you're going to get if you're not smart enough to realize this. Every real signal generator that is a pure resistive equivalent impedance, Thevenin impedance as it's called, behaves in this manner. So it may have a label on there traceable to the National Bureau of Standards with 0.01% accuracy. You're not going to get that accuracy in real voltage delivered unless you present the correct impedance. You'd be amazed how many people forget that. And it happens the other way around, too. What happens if my signal that I thought was 50 ohms, but it's really 10 ohms of load impedance, and I think I'm delivering 1 volt? You ain't going to get 1 volt. You're going to get something smaller. There's going to be a bigger voltage drop across the 50 ohm resistor that's on the inside of the signal generator. Anybody have any further questions or comments on this? K2RIW on the TechNet.
D2WGV.
You got it, John.
Dick, how can we be sure that the receiver input impedance is 50 ohms? I know the factories really don't specify that.
John, good question. Again, you're looking for a gross measurement here, John. I am suspecting that when you guys make this measurement, you're going to find 10 or 15 decibels of lacking sensitivity. I've seen a couple of evidences of it, and so I think that's what you're going to find. And if your receiver under test is supposed to be 50 ohms, and it's really 35 ohms or 79 ohms, that'll make the 0.1 microvolt that you should be measuring go up to 0.12 microvolts. That's not what you're looking for. You're looking for 0.1 microvolt, and I think you're going to measure 1 microvolt. You're going to measure a 10-to-1 voltage error. And by the way, there's all kinds of ways that you can go out and measure what is the real input impedance of your receiver if you want the next higher level of accuracy, but you don't need it. In this particular investigation, John, we're trying to find out, is it rape or murder? We're not trying to find out, is the knife that was used 4 inches or 4.1 inches long? I'm exaggerating a little bit, but I think you see the point. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Oh, this... No, it's just a question I had because I know that's not specified. So we're looking for a simple ratio test, basically. And if we can get that 20 dB of quieting, we know we've got a good receiver.
If you can get the 20 dB of quieting, if you get the 20 dB of quieting at a reasonable number of microvolts of signal that gives you that quieting. Go ahead, Wesley.
Oh, this speaker.
Utilizing the network analyzer or gain phase spectrum impedance analyzer for this purpose as the measurements of the RF amplifier and gain compression could be achieved by this method. Back to you.
In my opinion, Wesley, the very first measurement that you guys are going to measure is probably going to be on an 8660 Hewlett-Packard radio frequency type synthesized signal generator that's sitting very close to Todd Hill right now. That's my guess. You're going to connect the receiver, and you're going to make the measurement. If you measure a tenth of a microvolt, then it ain't the receiver. You got a bad cable, a bad antenna, something else is going on, or there's a blockage between you two. But if you measure something that's grossly different than what you expect, you measure a microvolt or 10 microvolts instead of a tenth of a microvolt, now the next step might be, is the receiver acting like a short circuit or an open circuit? In other words, you could take your impedance gain analyzer and look at the input terminals of the receiver and see how far away from 50 ohms it is. If you measure 1 ohm, you know you got a short circuit somewhere. If you measure 50,000 ohms, you got an open circuit somewhere. Something got blown out. Then that's the next level of investigation to find out what's wrong. And maybe you're going to open up the cabinet and whip out the schematic diagram and start tracing things and see where's the smoke, what got burned, what looks black, what printed circuit board opened up, an opened up land, an opened up solder joint, and things like that. But the very first test, in my opinion, is where do you stand? Where's the reference? What number of microvolts gives you 20 decibels of quieting?
Know how to make a contact on HF.
Now, was it John or Wesley that want to make a further comment on this?
Call this because...
Here's the thing that I have observed.
Eric recognized.
The video works like a charm before. I have never had a problem. This is a black version of Kenwood 2000, the limited edition. Only 1,000 of them were put on the market. And I've got a problem with the relay. This radio has a relay separate for each one of the bands, and on 2 meter has a separate power amplifier and a separate relay. So I didn't have one that is supposed to be there because it wasn't working properly, and that's what created my problem with the receiver. And then I used anything that I had on hand, and I have extended a little bit from the place that I have the printed board to the point that I have connected the relay about 1 inch in order for me to make a necessary connection. And I operated without any schematic at all. I was too lazy to get the schematic. So the radio is working good right now, but here's what I've got. I have the MFJ 921 antenna tuner for 2 meter, and before I was tuning this to minimal SWR. Of course, I've got it excellent, and I had no problem. Right now, I think the output of the transmitter part of 2 meter is no longer 50 ohms. And when I switch this antenna tuner to the power and tune it to the maximum power, I'm getting maximum power. And I can see also on the dial on the transceiver.
called is because West...
I see the maximum power possible to achieve. But when I switch on the antenna tuner to the SWR, then when the SWR is perfect, the dial on the display on the transceiver shows me only 10% of the power. So, for me it looks like not 50 ohm right now out of the transceiver is getting into the 50 ohm input of the antenna tuner. And then it's simply mismatching or pulling out the antenna tuner. I would like to hear some comments on that. Back to you.
Yeah, there's two factors going on here. Quite possibly an intermittent relay is one factor, and this interaction between the transceiver and the MFJ 921 antenna tuner. Let me go to the first one. I've seen relays that start becoming intermittent, like they've got dirt in them, or the read is not wiping correctly on the rotor or spatter contacts or whatever. And what some people have experienced is that they make a transmission, everything's hunky-dory, they release the microphone, the push-to-talk switch, and they want to go back to the receive mode, and the person they're talking to appears not to be there. In reality, the receiver is in its mode where the relay is not making good contact, and they get a lot of loss in the relay. What some people will do temporarily is click the transmitter, push the talk button a number of times, click, 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 and each time they're listening, and all of a sudden on one of those motions, all of a sudden the relay decides to make good contact. An intermittent relay will do that. And therefore, when you're doing the sensitivity test, don't do that, but it sure would be nice if you had the ability to click the relay a couple of times to find out when you measure at 1 microvolt sensitivity instead of a tenth of a microvolt sensitivity. Let me drop.
I'll give him a suggestion.
No, I use electronics. The relay that was offhand, any relay that I had on it, and they're on the extended wires, creating extra distortion to the resonant circuit.
Yeah, but you'd like to be able to click the relay a number of times to make sure that whatever sensitivity you measure is a repeated sensitivity. Do you measure the same number of microvolts of sensitivity 3 times in a row or 5 times in a row when you go from the transmit mode back to the receive mode? Because you might have an intermittent relay, or you might have something else funny going on, but do not transmit into the signal generator. You'd be amazed how many people have made that mistake. I'm one of them. And you'll burn up a signal generator front end when you do that. So you've got to find some other way of connecting the receiver to a dummy load while you go to the transmit mode, and then you release and go back and move the wire over to the signal generator to measure sensitivity. So how have you gotten around that problem to protect the signal generator? I guess one way is with a known good directional coupler, isn't it, Mel? In fact, that gets around the attenuator system, too. That's what I think Mel's going to tell us. And if he's not, we've got at least two other ways of getting around this. K2KEY, K2RIW. Eric recognized, Eric did come first. Eric, go right ahead with your comment.
Yeah, a couple things. A lot of Japanese radios use read relays. And read relays sometimes, they get manufactured imperfect, and they actually take a little magnetism and they become magnetized. So one quick cure for that particular issue of sticky read relay is to take an audio head degausser and hit it with an AC field a little bit, and that usually clears the problem up. It actually exercises the read and also eliminates any residual magnetism that the read has. Ultimately, the best way to measure it is with a service monitor, because you can put 150 watts into a service monitor. You can click your microphone on and off as many times as you want. You're not going to do any damage. Directional coupler is another way to do it. You also have to calculate the loss. That sort of thing. The other thing is, of course, is to kill the drive into the amplifier of the radio you're working on, and you can click it as many times as you want. That's what I wanted to say. K2RIW, K2RIW.
Yeah, very interesting that a read relay can become magnetized, and that gives you the sticky operation where you go from the transmit mode to the receive mode, and it's receiver-wise still stuck in the transmit mode. So by degaussing the reads of the relay, very nice. And by the way, when you do use a directional coupler, you don't have to calculate. If you know ahead of time you're using a directional coupler that has, let's say, at your particular frequency, because you're using it at a much lower frequency than the coupler is rated for. You maybe picked up a 10 dB coupler that runs at 10 gigs, but you're using it at 144 megs, or it's a 45 dB coupler, so to speak. And all you got to do is make a measurement straight through to the receiver and measure sensitivity, then make a measurement through the directional coupler and find out how many decibels more signal generator is required. And that'll tell you what is the real insertion loss on the coupled port. And the straight through port is going to the dummy load. And now if it's something like a 40 dB attenuator or 30 dB attenuator, that's the way your directional coupler is acting, you can transmit into that dummy load all day long without damaging the signal generator. The signal generator is going to be setting 45 dB higher. And so if you measure, if you expect to measure minus 130 dB of sensitivity, and you measure minus 90 instead, or minus 85, that's exactly where it should be because of the 45 dB of loss that's being overcome. There's nothing wrong with setting the signal generator at a higher power level to overcome the attenuation of your coupler that's being used. But once that coupler is there, you can now click multiple times into the transmit mode, and you can, in 10 seconds, you can do five operations and you see right away whether or not the receiver has the same sensitivity five times in a row. K2KEY, K2RAW. Go ahead, Mel.
This is K2KEY. Well, I had a similar situation, and I went back to the old-fashioned tap the board test, you know, tap the relay, and I could hear this breakup, and I thought the relay, you know, the relay's got dirt or something on it. It turns out the relay mechanically was coming loose from the circuit board. For some reason, I've seen this a number of times, that the solder seems to shrink away or move away in some of the old rigs, especially from the pins of the relay. Is it the mechanical vibration of the relay or whatever? But for some reason, I found that what I do after that, I re-solder the pins that build like a little hill up on them, of solder on them. It seems to hold much better. But it seems like that was very prevalent for many years, Dick. I wonder if you experienced that, over.
I experienced something a little bit like that. The diode rectifier that's in the power supply, it's inside of the rig you're listening to right now, a Kenwood TS711A, 2-meter all mode. The diode rectifiers, one or two of those diodes, decided to make an intermittent contact to the printed circuit board. And so the rig would occasionally just go completely dead, as if you had unplugged it. It just wasn't getting any power from its rectifier circuit. And when I finally found that, it just re-soldered it. So I guess it's mechanical stressing of the board, vibration of the relay itself. For whatever reason, intermittent contact can be built up. So tapping around. In fact, while the signal, if this is the best of all worlds, you'd have a directional coupler protecting your signal generator. The signal generator would be set 30 or 40 dB higher to overcome the loss of the attenuator. But the receiver is really transmitting into a dummy load on the straight-through port of the coupler. And now you can click the push the talk button multiple times to see if the sensitivity repeats. And while it's in the receive mode, you start hitting your knuckles on the cabinet of the receiver to find out if it's vibration sensitive. Does the sensitivity go up and down when you vibrate it? When you hit your knuckles on the right side, the left side, the top, the back, the front, and so on. And then when you get the cover off and you got your pencil in your hand and you start tapping on things. So this can give, these are some of the very good troubleshooting techniques when you know that something is not right. You're not measuring the right sensitivity. And so pinning it down, there's a whole art and science to doing that. And it's what these guys are telling you. So it should be a fun test. Out of curiosity, John, do you think you own a directional coupler that's made for a higher frequency than 2 meters that could be used in this service? I can teach you easily how to take a directional coupler that's rated for 10 gigahertz and use it at 10 megahertz if you want to, or use it at 144 megahertz. And the way it behaves out of band, if it's a strip line type directional coupler, they behave beautifully at an octave or a decade or two decades lower than the frequency they were rated for. They work like a charm, and it's very handy in a test like this. I wonder if you've got a machine like that, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Oh, this.
Dick, I do have a four-port coupler, a directional coupler made by HP. It's good up to, I think, 8 gig. Would that do?
Not necessarily. The fact that it's good up to 8 gig means that it's got a very broad, probably means it's got a very broad frequency range to it. So, good up to 8 gigs, what is the low end on it, and how many dB is the coupling coefficient? Over to you, John.
Dick, I don't have that on my bench. I don't know. I'd have to look for that item. But, okay, but I can buy one. Just recommend a particular type.
Hold on now. You don't have to buy anything. If it's one of those broadband ones made by HP, quite possibly it's rated for 2 to 8 gigahertz, for instance. 2 to 8 gigs. And in that frequency range, the straight-through line is a beautiful 50-ohm line, and the coupling is either 10 or 20 dB, whatever it says on the front panel. And there's nothing stopping you from putting on that straight-through line 100 watts of 144 megacycles, or 30 megacycles, into a dummy load. And now your 10 or 20 dB of coupling, whatever it's rated for, it's going to become a much higher number. Instead of 10 or 20, it's going to be 30 or 40, which is good, because you can evaluate it, and I can tell you how to calculate what it should be. So it turns out that a directional coupler used out of band at lower frequencies behaves in a very deterministic manner. You know what the sine wave looks like on a full wave rectifier. And the peak of that waveform on the full wave rectifier, if the horizontal axis was frequency and the vertical axis is response, the peak of that waveform, that's where the coupler is rated. That's where it's designed for. That's where the coupled line is exactly a quarter wavelength long. You get maximum coupling. And as you go down to lower frequencies, you're moving to the left on this chart, so to speak, and you're coming down from that sine wave in a very predictable manner. You go to half the frequency, it's the sine of 45 degrees instead of 90 degrees, and you're roughly 3 dB down, and it starts falling fast after that. So the exact voltage you're going to get is sine of theta, sine of 90 degrees or sine of 20 degrees. If the frequency is one-ninth of a frequency, one-ninth of 90 degrees where it was designed is 10 degrees. So sine of 10 degrees, you can easily look that up on a handheld.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Sine of 10 degrees, you can easily look that up on a handheld calculator. You know exactly what voltage you're going to get. Take the log of it, multiply it by 20. Now you know the 20, you know the extra decibels of attenuation of the coupled port because you're using it lower than the frequency was designed. If it was a 10 dB coupler, and you do that calculation and you find out there's 20 decibels of extra loss, 10 plus 20, it's now a 30 dB coupler. If you go to Roadrunner's, the website for Roadrunner's Microwave Group, there's an article in there by K2RIW that tells you exactly how to do that. And what I gave you right now is not easy to understand, but you read the article twice, and all of a sudden you'll say, yeah, why hasn't somebody told me about that sooner? Should I tell you the website for the Roadrunner's Microwave Group? KC2WGB, K2LIW.
Yes, Dave, I'd like to research that and read that a couple of times.
Okay, even if I don't get a chance to do it ahead of time, if you simply Google Roadrunner's Microwave Group, that'll get you to their website. And on their website, on their main page, you'll see one of the squares you can click on is called Technical Articles. You click on Technical Articles. When you're on that page, you go to the bottom of the page, and you'll find the K2RIW corner. They've taken about 10 of my articles that I've published on the web over the last few years, and they put them all together in one spot. And one of them is directional coupler measurements. How to use a directional coupler is the article we're talking about. While we're doing what we're doing for the next 10 minutes, I'll start looking it up for you and find you the exact URL. But I've given you enough information there that you will find it. Do you need a fill on that, John? KC2WGB, K2LIW?
KJ2WGB. No, Dick, you've given me enough information. I can chase that down. Name me for you to do it. If I have a problem, I'll give you a shout.
I have a question in Mintex. Go ahead. Okay, Mintex. John, I have plenty of this directional couplers. So we've been talking about it on TechNet a long time ago. I've made a video that I have sent to Dick as well. It was a treasure for $10. Anyhow, a question for you. I have a dual Yagi antenna that has vertical and horizontal built-in, and I place it completely vertically to the earth. And then I measure the characteristic, which is supposed to be circular, and then I replay, I put, let's say, 1 watt of power into it. Now, from the receiver standpoint, at whatever distance, I measure the singular strength with the typical ground plane antenna. Now, I replace the first antenna from the transmitter for the typical ground plane antenna, which is the vertical antenna. My question is, what is the difference between the circular characteristic of the cross Yagi, vertically placed, and the characteristic of the ground plane? Back to you.
Okay, now let me go slow on this one. Are you using a pair of crossed Yagis? A Yagi has got some horizontal elements and some vertical elements, and you're using it in the circular polarized mode, and you're aiming it at a vertical ground plane antenna. Is that the experiment?
Correct.
Okay. And you want to know what apparent gain will you see?
So what is the difference between this antenna and the typical ground plane antenna?
Okay. So your reference is a ground plane antenna transmitting to a ground plane antenna, and now you take the transmitter away from the ground plane antenna and you connect it to this cross-polarized Yagi instead. Is that the experiment?
Yes. That means that I would like to find out what would be the difference if, at the transmitter side, I use a vertically placed cross Yagi, and then I replace that Yagi with the ground plane, and I would measure that from the another ground plane at the receiver side at both instances.
Okay, so you're always receiving with a vertical ground plane antenna, and the reference measurement is a ground plane antenna doing the transmitting. The new measurement is the ground plane is the Yagi antenna being used. Let's assume now that the Yagi antenna has 10 dB of gain when you use the horizontal elements and 10 dB of gain when you use the vertical elements. And if you use the Yagi antenna vertical elements with 10 dB of gain, whereas the ground plane you used to use had, I'm going to pick a number out of the air, 1.5 dB of gain, you're going to see an 8.5 dB signal increase.
Moment. Both of the antennas are aiming to the sky. It means a ground plane is typically vertically polarized, and this antenna is also placed that is aiming to the sky, the same way.
Okay. When it comes to a Yagi antenna and you aim it to the sky because you're aiming at a satellite, that makes a lot of sense. Tell me how you take a ground plane antenna and aim it to the sky. Tell me what you mean by that.
Just typical way that you put it on the roof or of your car or your house. I just want to know the difference between circular characteristic of the cross Yagi antenna that has normally horizontal and vertical polarization, but it's just put vertically up, and the ground plane. Back to you.
Jack, you're trying to compare the side radiation of the cross-polarized to the radiation of a vertical.
Maybe yes, maybe no. If he's talking to a satellite, and the satellite spends a lot of its time near your horizon, in that particular case, you can use a ground plane. In that case, you can use a ground plane and talk to the satellite, or you can aim this Yagi antenna at the satellite. And when you do that, the Yagi antenna, if you're using just the single polarization elements, horizontal or vertical, and assuming the satellite is copolarized, the Yagi antenna might have 8 dB more gain than the ground plane. If the satellite is intended for circular polarization, and many of the ham radio satellites are intended for circular polarization, you're not only going to have the 8.5 dB more gain in the Yagi, but because you're using the Yagi in a circular polarized manner, and the satellite is intended for circular polarization, the 8.5 dB of gain increase gets another 3, and you're going to be now, 11.5 dB of gain better than the ground plane. When the satellite's on the horizon, the Yagi is aimed at the satellite, and the ground plane is used in a normal manner. So most of the guys doing satellite work much prefer to use a Yagi if they can aim it. There's the catch. You're now going to have an azimuth and elevation motor. Whereas the ground plane, as long as you get enough sensitivity, the ground plane is nice and convenient. You don't have to aim it, but you're going to get a pretty deep null when the satellite is straight overhead. Maybe this comes close. N2XJM, K2LIW.
Thank you very much. That's very much explained. I was just curious, as I like to know things to the depth. And of course, the test that you're mentioning, so, relay. As this relay I took from the electronics relay for 2 amps for simple home automatic. Anyhow, thank you very much. I have a few questions about HARP, but that later on if there are no more questions from the other people.
John, I've got one of the answers you're looking for. You want to go to www.kilo5romeomikegolf. That stands for Road RMG, Roadrunners Microwave Group. Yes, k5romeomikegolf.org. You go to www.kilo5romeomikegolf.org. You'll see the front page of Roadrunners Microwave Group. One of the blue buttons you can connect to there, one row down, one row over, is called Technical Forum. You click on Technical Forum, you get a whole bunch of technical articles. You go to the bottom of the technical articles, you'll find the K2RIW corner. And in there, you're going to find something called, where is it now? 3-centimeter directional couplers. I think it's the very first article. Yes, directional couplers. The very first article of the approximately 10 articles there. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 articles. Article number 1. And by the way, if you want to go straight there, it's a www.k5kilo5romeomikegolf.org/tech.html. That'll bring you directly to that article. You read that article on directional couplers, and you're going to find out how every one of the directional couplers you own can be used in a scientific manner to give you very exact measurements way outside of the frequency range where they're rated for. Need any fill on that, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW.
No, Dick, that's perfect, and I will take a look at that as soon as possible, probably tomorrow. One further question. I'm going to go from my HP generator. I'm going to take a nice piece of cable and directly go into my radio and into the receive port. Now, should I put a meter at the receive port to actually measure that voltage going in, or do you think I can depend on the generator?
If you care about the last dB or so of accuracy, you do care about the insertion loss of that piece of cable. Because if it's a 50-ohm cable, and the cable's got 3 dB of loss, then whatever voltage the signal generator is putting out, only 70% of that voltage is going to get to your load. So measuring the insertion loss of your cable. You can calculate it because you know you've got 10 feet of so-and-so cable that's got X number of dB per 100 feet, and you can do the mathematics of that. The dBs turn out to be linear with length, assuming the cable has got it's not soaked in salt water, and it's got connectors that are working correctly on the ends. And with your power meter, you can connect your power meter directly to the front panel of the signal generator, set some reference reading like minus 20 dBm, then put the cable in there and put the power meter on the far end of the cable. Now you will be measuring the insertion loss of that cable at your favorite frequency. Connect that cable directly to your signal generator, to your receiver under test. Don't worry about the impedance match. That's a minor factor, with rare exception. That's minor. And if you get a reasonable reading, like you expect a tenth of a microvolt and you get 0.15 microvolt, it's in the right ballpark, then it's most likely not an impedance error. But if you measure a 10-to-1 error in voltage, which is a 20-to-1 error in sensitivity, then, yeah, go ahead and measure this. Measure the input impedance of the receiver if you want to. But it's time you start tapping the relays inside and measuring the voltage on the LNA and find out if somebody blew it out. Something else is wrong. If the manufacturer tells you it's supposed to have this number of microvolts of sensitivity in the FM mode, and you measure 10 times higher than that, it's time to do some investigating. An impedance mismatch is a little bit less likely than other kinds of...
repeater, timeout, cancel.
It's a little bit less likely than other kinds of failure. How back to you, John.
Okay, Dick, wonderful news. I will try to set that experiment up and see if I can go with that. I don't think that'll be too much of a problem, but thanks a lot for that information, and I will apply it, and I'll be doing it soon. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, you've got the signal generators, you've got the receivers that you care about, and measure their sensitivity. Sometimes it gives you a warm and fuzzy feeling. Sometimes it's going to make you kind of unhappy until you find out what's going on, if the reading is significantly different than what the manufacturer says it should be, particularly when it comes to the product reviews of QST and whatever. Knowing what sensitivity your receiver should have, and some of these receivers, like the 2000, for instance, I think you've got a button you can push on the front panel that turns the preamp on and off and turns the 20 dB attenuator on and off. Measuring the sensitivity in those various modes should be a fun experiment. And so, your signal generator will produce the right number of microvolts if it sees something close to 50 ohms. It doesn't have to be 50 ohms plus or minus 1 ohm. If you're in the neighborhood of 30 to 80 ohms of load on the signal generator, close enough for this reading, because you're looking for a gross error in this particular circumstance, in my opinion. And I know that I was getting a lot of signal from you. The number of watts you were running and the number of watts I was running was not that different, and yet you were having a lot more trouble hearing me. So either there's some local, very strong signal that was giving you some kind of front-end overload, or the receiver sensitivity is a little less than you'd like it to be. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick, not to belabor the question, but do you think I should put the generator in a Faraday cage?
No. For a very good reason. Even if the leakage from the cabinet, getting through the leakage of the cabinet of your receiver, is giving you a phony sensitivity, you'll know that right away. When you're making a measurement at 146.850 megahertz, and you temporarily set the signal generator on 146.300, you know, something way out of channel, while it's set at the, you know, tenth of a microvolt mode, now any leakage from the cabinet is on the wrong frequency, and that's a super weak signal. It's not going to affect your receiver. And you measure the amount of noise coming out of your audio into that digital voltmeter or whatever it is in measuring the audio output, where you're going to do 20 decibels of noise quieting. Then you dial the receiver onto 146.85 in this example, and you start turning the signal generator down as low as it will go. Can you get to the same number as the signal generator off channel? If not, you know you've got some leakage, or the dial doesn't go far enough. And you'll know to be suspicious that the signal generator is going to have to be physically separated. Or the other approach is, when you use the directional coupler, the right amount of power coming out of the signal generator, if for instance it's a 30 decibel coupling coefficient, that you end up with. Let me drop. Once you're using a coupler that you know has got 30 dB of coupling coefficient, at your way of misusing the coupler, you're way down in lower frequency than it was designed for, and you've measured the coupler insertion loss, and it's 30 dB, you know that your signal generator must be set 30 decibels stronger to go through that coupler to give you the sensitivity you want to measure. Once the signal generator is set that much higher, the leakage from the cabinet is no longer a problem. It's opposite of common sense, I know. It's the basic oscillator way back in the beginning that leaks out, and he's running a milliwatt. And it's the amplifier downrange that you're turning up when you turn that knob. And that one doesn't leak, per se. Once you're using the coupler, and you're setting the signal generator to give the right sensitivity, all of a sudden this leakage from the cabinet problem usually goes away. But if you have any doubts, dial the signal generator off frequency and see if you come back to the noise level that would be there when there's a 50-ohm resistor, 50-ohm dummy load on the front end of the receiver. So there's all kinds of ways you can check this. But the coupler technique protects your signal generator from transmit power. Now with a dummy load on the coupler, on the straight-through port, you can click the push-to-talk switch multiple times and see if the receiver keeps coming back to the same sensitivity. Or is there an intermittent problem where three times in a row you get one sensitivity and the fourth time you get another one? Over to you, John, K2LIW.
I have a question of different nature.
John first and then Wesley. Go ahead, John.
She's got a...
Okay, Dick, that's sufficient. Thank you very much. And I will be doing that. You pick it up with Wesley. KC2WGB.
You got it, Wesley. Wait for the beep.
If I may ask all to have, leave us, we can ask a stupid question.
Into exam. I had sent you at March 11, which was 2 days ago, a very controversial video from the gentleman who soon will become ham radio operator, probably listening to this conversation right now. And for some, this video is simply not acceptable. But I have a question, and I pointed to which minute exactly of that video I had a question. Here's what happened. On the sky of Japan, the aurora was not seen for the last 26 years. About 15 minutes before the earthquake, the aurora was noticed. The video was posted. And at the same time, the gentleman has sent me the paper from Ionospheric Propagation on Radio Frequency Systems, Modeling Simulation Observation and Analysis by Department of Air Force and basically I had a few quotes from that.
What an idiot.
The there is the proposal for the contractors enabling to the Department of Defense HARP system to better to provide better measurement on heating dynamics of the ionosphere, and especially where they were interested with onset plasma effects caused by ionospheric heating. That leads also to the lensing and mirroring effect artificially created. There was another paper from Stanford University and Education, and this one is very much high-level scientific paper, which actually sent plenty of F-ionosphere heating, magnetospheric injection and heating, the beam pointing, not pointing, so you could actually paint the heating patterns on the sky, waved in plasmas, plasmas properties, the HF and low frequency heating theory, electron temperature, modeling ionosphere. HF wave propagation and model construction for heating. And of course, energy balance at one altitude.
What an idiot!
Let me stop.
What an idiot! As it's very loud, it goes blah, 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 blah. He's an idiot!
I got him at an S7.
Here is the point. From that video, that is very much controversial, the guy states about the ability to reflect the energy from the ionosphere back to the Earth. And I was thinking about it. If we have a rays from the sun, and we take the piece of glass that could actually concentrate this waves at one point, then we could simply burn the wood and create the fire. Now, if the lensing could be artificially created by heating ionosphere, or lensing and mirroring, then we have a perfect weapon. Now, if the first pulse and the first frequency is being used for the purpose of artificially altering the ionosphere, then the second beam of different frequency would be the one that could cause actually any kind of mirroring effect when it's reflected. And I would like to hear something about that from you. Why Department of Defense is so much interested with that area? Back to you.
This is very... What an idiot! All that...
In the case of the HARP-like experiment, where you've got this phased array on the ground, and I think, but I'm not positive, they have the ability to electronically steer that beam in microseconds. So they can paint a strong beam onto which portion of the sky they care about. To my knowledge, the main motivation for a HARP is to create an artificial ionosphere that allows a beyond normal line of sight communication to take place in specific areas. In other words, if I've got a transmitting site and a receiving site, and they're, let me pick a number, 1,500 miles apart, and they normally do not hear each other reliably, but I want to transmit data between the two places. And if I can heat the ionosphere between the two, I can transmit that data during the time that I care about it, and then no one else will get a chance to use it because I turn off the HARP transmitter, and that ionized path is no longer there. It dissipates in a fairly short period of time. It's those kind of things that I think they're doing, as well as the basic physics of understanding how the ionosphere works. I believe the ionosphere is coming from a combination of ultraviolet radiation out of the sun, as well as the solar wind. Some combination of solar wind and ultraviolet, and maybe a little bit of cosmic ray, is really creating the ionization. The aurora borealis, let me drop. The aurora borealis happens near the north magnetic pole and near the south magnetic pole because these particles of solar wind, which are real particles boiled off from the sun, millions of pounds of stuff every second is being boiled off from the sun. Not to worry, a lot of stuff is falling into the sun too. It's not losing, at least not losing very fast. These particles align themselves, because they're charged particles, they align themselves with the Earth's magnetic field, and they jump back and forth between North Pole and South Pole, and I think that's one of the major constituents of the so-called Van Allen Belt, the inner and outer Van Allen Belt. And where they dip down near the poles and touch the atmosphere, these high-velocity particles give you that air glow that we call the aurora. Now, if you want to take the ionosphere and paint just the right kind of a picture onto it with this phased array where you can steer it electronically in microseconds, and you want to do focusing with that on the ground, I presume. I wonder about that. I think the
question is, are they able to create lensing that could actually take the arrays from the sun and direct to the particular region in geographically in the Earth's surface? That's one question. Or if they're talking about extra low frequency and very low frequency generation and propagation of physics in terms of ionosphere in the HARP program, how that is related?
The first question is, could you get enough focusing? I'm not convinced that the degree of ionization that they're creating is anywhere near as high as you think. In number of ionized particles per cubic meter, yeah, it's a great big number. But they're creating an amount of ionization that when you take a radio signal hitting the ionosphere at a grazing angle, you get enough reflection to be useful. That's a very minor amount. It's very similar to what's happening with the X-ray telescope. If you take a look at NASA's X-ray telescope, ordinarily an X-ray will go right through a lens like the lens is not even there. But you know that when you look at the storefront window at a store that you're to the glass, you do get a nice big reflection. Many reflecting surfaces behave that way. The X-ray telescope that NASA has put up, I think they put up two of them now, has a bunch of concentric, what looks like tubes. It looks like a cylinder. It's a bunch of concentric cylinders. They've got a very gentle hyperbolic shape to them. And now the X-rays come into the X-ray telescope, and they glance at a grazing angle against these concentric cylinders that have this gentle shape, and focusing takes place. I think the ionosphere is like that. In other words, it'll give you grazing angle reflection. But for a main for a signal coming normal to the ionosphere to do focusing, I don't think there's anywhere near enough thickness in miles, anywhere near enough ionospheric ionization to the level to do that. That's my first guess. I don't know. I'm really out of the woods on this one. But that's my guess. To focus ultraviolet.
I spoke to John and about that, and I was thinking that. If the lensing would be created at a very large scale, few kilometers length, and since the HARP is interested with extra low frequency and very low frequencies, then if the first beam is creating the artificial lensing, and the second very high power, now we're talking about resonance. What do you think was the resonance frequency of the Tacoma Bridge when it collapsed?
You asked the resonance frequency of the blank when it collapsed. I missed that word.
Resonance frequency of Tacoma Bridge when it collapsed. What do you think was the frequency?
Okay, you're talking about the Tacoma Narrows Bridge. And that was oscillating in the vicinity, from the movies I saw, if the movie wasn't speeded up, around one cycle per second or a half a cycle per second, and it required a wind of something like exactly 37 miles an hour or whatever. There was a very specific wind speed that would set up an oscillation on that bridge, and the bridge had no damping function. It was a high Q oscillator that was very vulnerable to a particular wind speed, and they used to call that bridge Galloping Gertie. And eventually an oscillation that got large enough in magnitude that it failed. So is that the question you're asking? Go ahead.
Yeah, what I'm thinking is it possible that the second beam, forget for a moment that we just created artificial lensing and we're trying to take the average from the sun and concentrate on certain geographic area. Let's say there is a different story. The first beam is actually creating the lensing. The second beam is actually sending extra low frequency, and then this energy reflected could hit anything that is within the length of the resonance frequency of that extra low frequency energy beam. What would be then the reaction of this object?
When it comes to real low frequencies, the D layer absorption starts giving you a lot of grief. The E and F layers are where the ionization is more useful, but the degree of ionization is nowhere near high enough in magnitude, nowhere near thick enough to give you a substantial amount of focusing of anything coming out of the sun. You want to focus the optical, the ultraviolet, or something like this on a particular spot by painting a lens in the ionosphere with a Hopf experiment. I'm really a fish out of water on this one. I don't know. But I'm starting off very skeptical. I don't think...
Here's the point. No matter what frequency is from the second beam, because one scenario was creating artificial lensing and then trying to use the energy from the sun and send it to the geographic area of the choice. The second one is the first set of the frequency is creating the lensing, shaping the lensing as they are able to paint something on the ionosphere. And then the second beam is actually the beam at the frequency of choice that will actually affect anything that is within the length wave diameter at the surface of the Earth. Back to you.
Okay, now I don't know. There's a major construction project going on at my house. I haven't had a chance to look at any of my emails yet, and so it's going to be another couple of days before I can get to them. So I really don't know yet what you sent me, and I haven't had a chance to view that material. But my understanding of the amount of heating that HARP is able to create, I don't think is anywhere near the magnitude that you're talking about. On top of that, even when HARP does its heating and it's doing its flashing all over the place with electronic steering, the recombination time is something else you've got to consider. You may ionize a certain patch, and you turn off the HARP transmitter in a very short period of time, that ionization disappears. So to sustain a whole lot of volume of space, a volume of ionosphere, that is sustained at an extremely high level of ionization, plasma-like physics, I don't think they have anywhere near that capability. That's my first guess. But it's
this is the power of the Japanese nuclear reactor that it's in kilowatts. What do you think?
It's not kilowatts. It's a whole lot of megawatts. I think many nuclear power stations are in numbers like 50, 100, 150 megawatts. Go ahead, John.
Right people with the right money, what is the problem to deliver a very, very significant amount of energy to any program of choice? If we use the same energy for the millions of households. Back to you.
Okay, I see what you're saying. Go ahead, John. You had a comment about how big are those nuclear power stations in megawatts?
No, Dick, actually, I was going to ask you to help me understand this HARP nonsense that we're talking about. I remember back in the 60s and 70s when we were working with scatter radar and scatter communications. Is that basically an improvement on that technique? Is that what they're doing?
Yeah, you're talking about over-the-horizon radar. And over-the-horizon radar used a very large parabolic-shaped antenna in many of the cases, sometimes a great big phased arrays. The Russian woodpecker apparently was one of these things, and you've seen some pictures of that. There's a website that'll show you the Russian woodpecker. Man, what a big phased array that is. A whole bunch of dipoles with reflectors built at the, you know, rather low frequencies. If you radiate enough power, the ionospheric reflection will allow you to see a echo, radar-like echo, at the many thousands of miles.
Thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
KC2QIQ.
I'm not convinced that the woodpecker or these over-the-horizon radars were creating artificial ionization, but there I'm not sure. Glenn, do you think they were creating artificial ionization? Over to you, Glenn.
Yeah, I think they were, Dick. But an interesting point, though, about the power out of a nuclear power station. A typical household is somewhere like around 25, oh my goodness, 25,000 kW is the capability of a typical house. So, and if you take 500,000 households, that's somewhere